Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the book they have written, are in the process of writing, or intend to write someday. My co-host for the program is Stone Payton. You don't have your name tag on yet that says, you said you were going to get a name tag that says Vital Cog, which I tell everybody you are.
I've got it ordered.
You've got it ordered? Yes, I want to see it next week. Good morning. How are we, actually?
I'm doing well, man. I'm enjoying this kind of soaking rain. That's going to be good for the crops, right? Mm-hmm, and the grass is going to keep growing, so I'm excited about that.
So that we can keep mowing the lawn, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Keep my neighbor employed. My buddy Sean does all that.
Aha. Uh-huh. And how's Business Radio X these days?
Going really well. We've launched 7 shows in the last 30 days. We just talked with a lady yesterday, and I'm not allowed to announce it yet, but we have a new show that we just settled on yesterday, and so we continue to grow, man. We're having a good time with
That's great. I'm glad. I delight being a part of Business Radio X. Well, you know, Stone, an overarching theme in each edition of Right Here, Right Now is encouragement. And through our guest interviews and conversations, we strive to provide encouragement to those who harbor a desire to write, but who have yet to do so. We all have that story, a unique insight, or an amazing memory, or a hope that we want to share with others. And our guests today provide pure encouragement to those who long to write but have hesitated to start. I've talked with them, each of them, prior to coming in here. I've looked at their websites. I'm excited about interviewing them. We're going to start with Emily Francis. It's Emily Francis Smith now, right?
Francis is my new name.
It's the
so
new
Smith
name.
Was my maiden name.
Okay, because I saw that all over wherever I was this morning on YouTube. So
yes.
We want to make sure the world knows you as Emily Francis, and
correct.
She's smiling ear to ear. Well, she found herself consumed with fear and anxiety, which... Well, that kind of kept you from pursuing your personal goals and dreams, right?
Most certainly.
Okay. Well, then to help you overcome that, you wrote From Fear to Faith, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So through your books and speaking, you focus on helping people face fears and feel more comfortable in their skin. And you challenge them with this thought, you can wish for a different outcome or a different life all you want, but if you're not willing to put in the work... You're not going to get there, right?
Absolutely.
Well, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
So fear and anxiety, completely consumed by them, and yet you wrote a book, and that intrigues me because a lot of people are afraid to write, and it's not for the faint of heart. How did you come about doing all of that?
I started writing because when I was going through the anxiety, I searched out every book I could possibly get my hands on about anxiety, and what I found was... Nobody talked about their story. They either were therapists, so it was, here's how you analyze your way out of a panic mm-hmm. attack, which if you analyze as an anxious person, you will be in the hospital with a panic attack.
Yes,
it
I would
does
think
not
so.
Work that way.
I would
so
think
if you
so.
Start going through the motions of analyzing, you're going to go deeper and deeper into the what-if territory.
Uh-huh.
What if?
Mm-hmm.
What if I'm actually going to pass out right here? You know, you start analyzing, well, let's think about this. How's your breathing right now? Is something numb? What's twitching? So... The analyzing your way through is really a backwards way, and I appreciate all the therapists that wrote those wonderful books, but I didn't get any better from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the spiritual books that I found about having hard times, they also did not share how bad things were. It was more the I healed and you can too. And I felt like they didn't want to lose face by really being honest about how bad it really was. And when you're lost, it's very, very lonely, and you want somebody to tell you that you're not alone and you're not crazy. So I wanted to hear more of where these people were coming mm-hmm. from, and a lot of people didn't give it up. And since I'm a very honest person and I was so lost I couldn't see my way up and out, mm-hmm. the only thing that I could do was go down and in and start documenting my progress, and then knowing in my heart that no matter how I figured this out, one day I would share my story with the world and they would feel like they're not alone too.
I appreciate that, and I hope my listeners really grab hold of that, because you represent what I promote and believe in myself, and I'm not alone on that, and that is everybody has a book inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you read the authorities.
I did.
On both sides, and they still weren't sharing what you needed. And so you recorded your own, and the rest is history.
Absolutely.
And you've been on your way ever since, right?
I do have to put in a side note. I read the book Conversations with God and fell in love with it. And I wrote him an email. And I was really lost. And I was like, dear Neil,
that's
my
gutsy.
Buddy.
That's
I wrote him an email and I said, you know, I want to know how bad it really was for you. I want to know because I'm lost and I'm sitting here in a pile of quicksand and I don't know how to move forward. And 2 years later, Neil Donald Walsh endorsed my book.
Yes, he did.
And I got to be on his radio show.
Oh, my all goodness.
All from that letter of me saying, help, how did you do it? Give me a little bit more. I want to know.
Well, see, that triggers something for me, too. I wrote an article on depression when I was in depression. Mm. And a poem that always spoke to me in those battles was Rod McEwen's poem. You're probably not old enough to remember that name. Now, my next guest, Jim, is.
I do.
Rod McEwen wrote a poem simply entitled 39. And I wanted to use it in my publication. And I just shot an email out to him. He called me.
Love it. I love it.
I said, whoa, is this great or what? That's another thing. If we can encourage people to shoot big, to aim high and go for stuff like that, can't we?
We're all human. Why is it? Nobody's going to know your work is great if nobody has the guts to come up and tell you so.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to realize all these people are just people. So like, I actually had a woman write me a letter about my book saying, I finally feel like I have a friend and I wanted to contact you. I was standing in the post office reading it on my phone crying.
Wow.
Because I got the letter that I wrote to Neil all those years ago and now she's one of my dear friends.
Oh, that's sweet, isn't it? Well, what was the biggest challenge for you to actually get underway writing?
Oh, man. The biggest challenge for me was that the writing part is actually the easiest part because you almost vomit on the paper and then clean it up later. And I tell people
like that.
Everybody that. If you're thinking about writing a book, just vomit on the page. Don't worry about your editing. Don't worry about
That's
your
right.
stuff. Just throw
That's
it all
right.
up. Mm-hmm. Go clean it up later. Mm-hmm. And so that part was the easy part because I didn't talk to anybody else. So the writing became my dearest friend. But then I got all these grandiose ideas. My friend calls it running around town with my wedding dress on because I would decide that these monster publishers were going to pick me up and I was going to be traveling the world, soon. And the whole world would know me because I come forward and I'm going to be like Neil Donald Walsh's second in command now. We're buddies here,
Boy,
and
you were waiting for a big downfall, weren't you?
I was. And so I was putting together these incredible book proposals and reading all the book proposal books and sending them out to everyone. And then they would get sent back to me. This is not from an agent. Thank you very much. We won't open it.
Oh my.
A couple people would send you a nice letter. So for me, the hardest thing was understanding that I can still make my way by myself, which was hard.
Mm.
But if you're really determined, you'll figure it out. It will line up. You just have to figure out which door is going to open. So I'd say that was my biggest challenge, was figuring out how to open those doors.
That's exciting. And you found a way.
I like the down and in instead of up and out, because I've always heard people talk about up, and I like that. That's cool.
I had to go down deep. I really did. I mean, I had to get to know the depths of my soul and what I'm capable of in the highs and in the lows. A lot of people just want to know their really good parts. But you have to know your triggers, and you have to know how low and deep you really run.
And that's a scary journey to take.
It is not easy, and it's lonely. And it is very scary because you don't want to see the bad sides of you. But it did make me come to this. The biggest frustration I have with the people at large is those of us who do not take responsibility for our behaviors and actions. And there's a lot of them. A lot of people will rationalize why it's okay for them to behave in certain ways, not okay for you, pointing fingers, and never looking within and having a personal awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I got to come through that. So now it's like I own my stuff. When I mess up, I'll say I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, and I still find that to be one of my most aggravating things to see in people is those people that don't really know who they are, how they're perceived, and what they're capable of in the best ways possible, and also the opposite way.
And it's okay to say, oops, I'm sorry.
You're human.
Yeah.
We're running around with these crazy masks on all the time, trying to look so perfect and so great. And the truth is, everyone has a story. When I came forward and started telling my secret that, well, I have anxiety. What most people said? Me too.
Mm, imagine that.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, you do a lot of presentations in hospitals or with cancer patients?
I work with cancer support groups.
How does that work? What do you do?
I work with SIGO, Southeast Gynecology Oncology Association, and I speak about my anxiety and help them to put it towards when they're going through chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I come in and I tell my story, and I'm not, you know, my story is different than everybody else. Where I was sick was in my mind and in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt sick all mm-hmm. the time because mm-hmm. of it. And I was always afraid that everywhere I went, I was going to drop dead or something was going to happen. And so going in and working with these amazingly powerful women, they, I'll quote one of the people that I love dearly that unfortunately did not survive her cancer journey, but she said, "You'll never meet an atheist in the chemo suite." And so I start there. Uh-huh. I always say, "Lisa Ballantyne, I love you so much, and I'm going to quote you, and this is how I'm going to present today's anxiety lesson, is I'm never going to meet an atheist in the chemo suite, because when you're that close, there's no way you're going to push away your spiritual mm-hmm. faith and foundation. Mm-hmm. And just, you're going to open to new insights and new availabilities in your heart, and they're the most beautiful people in the world to work with."
They are. They are.
They are.
I say that out of having been a hospice chaplain, and so I encountered a lot of those.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I quoted you a little bit in the opening, and that is, you can wish all you want, but there is some work that's necessary. That's the abbreviated version. Yes. Talk to us about that.
So, you know that anonymous quote, don't ask God to guide you if you're not willing to move your feet?
Mm.
When I was really anxious, I would sit back, watch TV, watch people, and think, if I wasn't anxious, I would be doing blank, whatever it is. You know, I could do that. You know, all those thoughts that you have in your head, but you can't even get up and get out of your house to go make your difference. And mm-hmm. for somebody like myself, who was a collegiate cheerleader and aerobic director and built my life on inspiring others, now all of a sudden I can't move. I'm completely paralyzed. You have to do the work. You got to claim it. And mm-hmm. and it, you can't, I also always say, you can't have somebody show up at your door if they don't know your address. Because there's a lot of people that sit.
You are full of wisdoms, aren't you?
You know, I make up all, they're like my own little Emily-isms, but because I listen to my friends that are doing their work, but only to a point. They're almost more afraid of success.
Mm-hmm.
And so they expect that if they put in a minimum amount of work, it's supposed to go big. And it doesn't work that way. And if you want to make a difference, it has to start with you. You cannot expect people to make things happen for you. It just doesn't work that way. So you got to get in, figure out who you are, figure out what you want to do, who you want to be, and then go do it.
Now, you've written more than one book, correct?
I have, yes.
What's the other one?
Well, I have Anxiety Sucks.
Well, that matches.
I wrote that one first, and it's uh-huh. the non-spiritual version of From Fear to Faith. And
oh, okay.
Anxiety Sucks is a very, it's a smaller book, and it's your support book. It's mm-hmm. not my story. It's not about me. It's just, hey, how's your breathing? What's twitching? Where's it numb? Those are the chapters. So you go through anxiety symptoms and then the best coping skills that I can come up with. And the idea is, anxiety sucks. Your life doesn't have to, and you're not alone.
So it's your clinical book, right?
It's my clinical. It's my, for the non-spiritual loves of my life, this is the more mainstream that uh-huh. people can read. And also, I wrote it to be short because when you're really anxious,
you don't want to sit still.
You want to get to the point.
Yeah.
And so, like, in fact, I wrote a part in there. My friend is a personal trainer, and he was with this woman in the gym in the morning, and she didn't wear makeup that day. And all of a sudden, the gym just happens to be really crowded, and she feels like everybody's looking at her. And he turned to her and he goes, "You ain't all that." That's the same thing with anxiety. When you're anxious, you feel like everything's about you. It's a mm-hmm. very, unfortunately, selfish condition, mm-hmm. and everything's about you.
Mm-hmm.
So I would look in the mirror and go, "You ain't all that. Now, you're wonderful and I love you. You ain't all that." They don't care. They're dealing with their own anxiety. And so I put that in the book. You know, when you get overly anxious, you need to check yourself.
Oh, that's... I like that. I just, you know, the downside to radio is the listeners can't see your facial expressions going on, and this is fun. Well, what do you read?
Well, I used to read self-help books all the time, and my friends would ask me to go on a self-help vacation, and I didn't find any joy in other books. Now I read a lot of autobiographies.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of just fun, lighthearted books. I just mm-hmm. finished Mackenzie Phillips' book, High on Arrival.
Okay.
It was a mind-blowing book, I must say.
I'll bet.
Absolutely mind-blowing. But I like hearing other people's stories that are willing to tell me how dark it really got. Tell me how great it really got.
And what advice would you give to other business people or people in general that are contemplating writing?
vomit that stuff on the paper, my friends. You got to get started.
Boy, I set her up, didn't I, Stone?
You did. That was perfect.
You have to get, that's all. The advice is, whatever you're thinking about doing, don't wait.
Mm-hmm.
Just do it.
Well, I am delighting in this conversation, but I need to go on to our
no,
other guests.
No, thank you so much for having me.
But first, you're not off that okay. easy. How do people contact you?
My website is anxietysucks.net.
You're serious?
Totally.
Okay.
They can find me there, or emilyafrancisbooks.com.
All right. And anxiety sucks, huh?
Anxiety
and you ain't all that.
You ain't all that.
I'm going to use that five times.
Isn't
before
that
I go to
awful?
Bed tonight.
Doesn't it cut you down? It
no.
really
well,
lets
I
you know.
I have a 14-year-old, so she thinks
you're
going
to have to really use that sometimes. Because
it's all about her right now, you know? Mm-hmm.
It is, especially a little girl. I hate to say
and
it.
She is all that in a lot of respects, but I'm still going to use that phrase.
I say right after it. Right after that, you ain't all that. It's you're a very specific part of this planet, and nothing would be the same without you. We love you, but you ain't all that.
And you say that with this big grin
that's
on
funny.
Your face.
Because I love that statement. How can you not smile
I
when
work
you
on the
say
tone.
That?
I got to get that little neck snap. Like
you
got
to get a little attitude when you say it. But thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and you're going to stick around, right?
I am.
Good. Well, Jim Harvey, our next guest, taught for a year in high school, and I we're going to talk about this in a second, Jim. But he says he tried to join the military during the Vietnam War, figuring he'd rather be in Vietnam than in the classroom again.
Absolutely true.
And there's got to be a story there. But there as is. Much as the military wanted people back then, they didn't want him. So with that, I mean, what other thing are you going to do? He began a successful career with IBM, retired, yep. and had a second successful career in commercial real estate brokerage and development.
Yep.
But the stories from your childhood of German submarine activities off the shores of America echoed in your mind.
Yep.
And so you took those stories, added your own spin, and you wrote a novel called Grayton Beach Affair.
Correct. Thank
Welcome.
You. Thank you, Tim. I'm glad to be here.
I got to jump right on it. You
sure.
know that. Let's hear the tease story first. Why Vietnam over the classroom?
Oh, okay. I graduated from a small school in South Alabama, Troy State College, right at the height of Vietnam. And I was I wanted to go into the military, actually, and I wanted to go in as an officer. But I was heavily in debt, so I decided, I found out the day I graduated from college that I could actually get a job teaching and get a deferment from the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so my intent was to teach and pay off some debt and then go in as an officer. And I did teach. I didn't go to school to be a teacher. My undergraduate degree is in marketing and business. But they needed teachers, and Key West was mm-hmm. a nice place to be. So I went to Key West. I taught for the year. But at the end of that year, I realized that, A, I didn't want to be a teacher, and, B, it was time for me to do my duty. And quite frankly, I had thought that life in the military would probably be better than life in a high school classroom. So I actually voluntarily went up to take the officer candidate physical, and they mm-hmm. found some fluky things that actually turned out not to be accurate. But they gave me a six-month deferment. While they went through the medical analysis stuff before they called me back and cleared me. But in that six-month period, I met my wife, was asked to come to work for IBM, started a really nice career with IBM. And so I did a 180 on wanting to go into the military at that point. So I never did go into the military, but it wasn't, I was trying to avoid it. It just circumstances.
Yeah, one of those things, yeah.
Yeah, just one of those things. It just didn't work out, which was fine because at the time, my IBM career was taking off. And so I had a 30-year career with IBM, took an early retirement from IBM, went immediately into Atlanta, commercial real estate, brokerage, leasing, ended up vice president in one of the largest office parks here in Atlanta. And then did some of my own, worked with a developer for some small medical mm-hmm. office buildings and wound that down. But I had grown up, I'm from South Alabama, and I'd also grown up on the panhandle of Florida. And my grandmother owned a home in Fort Walton Beach on the panhandle of Florida. And my older brother, who's 6 years older than I, lived there during the war and was telling me as we were growing up, I was born in 45, so I was born right after the war, but mm-hmm. he was born in 39. So he was telling me about, he would tell me as we were growing up, stories he would hear about German submarine activity off the coast of Florida and hearing rumblings offshore where German submarines were torpedoing Allied ships.
Now, you being the younger brother, Because I'm one of those.
Yeah.
Was he just telling you those, or was he trying to scare the bejesus
out of
you?
No. It was just fascinating stories. I mean, okay. I'm the typical red-blooded little American boy who loves that kind of storyline, right, still right. do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but we would he would talk about the house having to have the blackout shades to keep the submarines from being able to see lights on shore. And so as I was winding down my... my real estate career, I had a lot of time. I had the time. I have too much energy. I'll never retire. And in the back of my mind, there was a story that I was not sure a lot of people were aware of about just what the German submarine activity was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, you know, I think there's a story there, and I think I'll just write what I want to write about it. And I kind of formulated the seed of a storyline that ended up being the basis for the book. And as I started doing research, I then found out about the German prisoner of war camps that were all throughout the United States in the South, particularly in the South, and there was and in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought 378,000 German soldiers to the United States during World War II and used them as labor. We housed them in 45 different states. And throughout Florida, they used them a lot, in Alabama, Georgia, but they were used as labor.
They also used them in Kentucky, and I can because when Stone and I did a remote at the Decatur Book Festival, one of the authors that we interviewed has written a book about the German prisoners of war in the state of Kentucky.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
So it's neat to hear you talk about that. So continue.
So what I decided to do, I started doing research, and I found out, you know, more about it. So the basis of my story started, and to say again what Emily said, the idea of writing means you have to sit down and start to write. I sat down in one day on my word processor and just simply started to write. I think Emily said it, but I would say it again. Don't worry about what you're writing. Just start to write. And it doesn't matter. You could start out a story with the worst cliche. You could say it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, but, you know, John still needed to go buy that new Chevrolet, or, you know, however you want to do it.
There you go, yeah.
By the time you go through the editing and rewriting and editing and rewriting, you'll get it the way you want to say it. So my first piece of advice to an aspiring writer would be just write.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the storyline, I'll talk a little bit about the book, and then I'll talk a little bit about the writing process, at least from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my storyline, and mine is a fact-based but a fictional story about a young man from Germany who was brought to the United States with his parents, educated in the United States before World War II, disenchanted with how he was treated as a German, decides to go back to Germany prior to the war. The war comes along, and he's trying to keep his head down, and the German Nazis of the military find out that he can speak English without an accent. And he's very familiar with American culture. So they coerce him to board a German U-boat or submarine to come to the United States, the coast of Florida, come ashore, come inland, and extract a high-level German officer from a prisoner of war camp, getting back to Europe so he can be used for the war effort. So in writing in that, I had to do a lot of search and research on German submarine activity in the war. Found out that there were 24 German submarines that came into the Gulf of Mexico and damaged or sank 70 Allied vessels.
So it's more than rumor.
That wouldn't really happen. And I have, you know, a lot of the research you show, I have a photograph of German sailors standing on the deck of their submarine watching the Empire Micah, which was sank off Apalachicola.
Oh, my.
In June of 42. So... in the story, this young man comes ashore with the idea he's going inside to get this German officer out, and he meets a young lady living in the little coastal town of Grayton Beach. And those of us from this area may be familiar with Grayton Beach. It actually was a little community there during World War II. So I describe life in Grayton Beach during World War II, life on a German submarine, life in a prisoner of war camp. The prisoner of war camps were really minimally guarded because they realized quickly that there was really no place for the Germans to go if they were to break out. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they didn't speak English, and they weren't going to go anywhere, so they were minimally guarded. And so I put a young lady who is living in Grayton Beach. Her fiancé had been killed in World War II, so she's grieving. So the protagonist of the book comes ashore with the idea of going inland, and he meets Maggie, the young lady, and all kinds of things happen. Involvement with the police, then all of a sudden they need each other to survive. They have a brief, passionate affair, leaving each with deep but unsettled feelings for the other. But he departs, goes back to Europe, where he has an opportunity to reconsider his future. So he joins the resistance in France. So I had an opportunity to do a lot of research on the resistance. And during this time, he saves an American flyer who's from Atlanta, and the American flyer invites him to come back after the war, start over again. And he does, but he wants to do it with the idea of starting over again, but also to track down and find this young lady that he had met a couple years ago.
Find that woman.
That's kind of the summary of the story.
Okay.
And I leave, you know, the book says, you know, does he find her and could they have a future together? So that's the kind of story.
We're driving sales here, right?
really trying. That's right.
That's good. That's good. Well, when you were writing, were you writing while you still had a day job, so to speak?
I did. You know, that's a good question, Tim. My writing style is probably different than any other author that I know of, and certainly not one that I would recommend for the professional author, but it would work for me. I wrote when I felt like writing.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote when you felt the same way, Emily. If you listen to authors talk, they will talk about the fact that they get up, you know, they write 6 hours a day or whatever mm-hmm. they do, a lot mm-hmm. of them. But I didn't. I wrote when I felt like writing. And one key that was important to me, and I will share this, I told absolutely no one except my wife that I was writing a book. No one knew it. Best friends, family. I did that because I wanted to do this on my own schedule. I wanted to do it in my own time frame. And I did not want to go to cocktail parties and people say, well, how's the book coming, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to have any deadline. It was not under a deadline by a publishing house. So I wrote when I felt like writing. I took 2 years to write it. And then I had another year to edit it and get it ready for publishing. So second piece of advice is, from my perspective, is the fewer people you tell, the less pressure on you to, you know, to finish it on a certain deadline.
And I can encourage people on that because I have clients who come to me and say, man, they're all over me. Got to get it done.
Yeah. So the other thing, and so when I wrote the manuscript, my book is fiction, which falls into a completely different category, particularly from a marketing perspective, than a mm-hmm. nonfiction book. Emily and I were talking before the meeting, you know, if you write a nonfiction book, there's always some audience out there that's interested in your, you know, mm-hmm. subject matter. When you write fiction, and they all say this, all the advice that I got was, you know, fiction is harder to sell because you have to create a marketplace for fiction. So that's what I was facing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I wrote the book. I had never been to a writing class. I'd never read how do you write a novel. I have 40 years of business and marketing and a law degree, so I appreciate the English language. But I had never gone to, you know, how to write a novel. I've read enough to know how the story needs to go along, flow along, and you have to keep people interested in the mm-hmm. storyline. You can't give away too much too early and those kinds of things. So I ended up with a manuscript of about 113,000 words. Today's popular fiction should be somewhere between 80 and 100,000 words.
That's right.
So when I finished the manuscript, I found a wonderful editor up in Pennsylvania, sent the story to her. She's an author, and she also... So she liked it. She said, Jim, this is a great storyline, but it needs a lot of work. So she said, let's use my editor, my personal editor. A lady happened to be in Edinburgh, Scotland. But so we sent the manuscript off, and I got what had gone as 113,000 words, came back at 78,000 words.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And I found all of the things they fixed, a mm-hmm. lot of the things that I just didn't know to fix.
Mm-hmm.
But had I not done it the way I did it, had I researched how to do it, gone to writing school, gone to this, gone to that, I never would have written the story. So I'm a jump in the pool and learn how to swim kind of a guy.
And that's not a bad way to go.
No, for me it worked. Mm-hmm. And so I'm certainly open to the criticism and would look forward to it. I got a manuscript back that was there was as much red line in it as there was, black lining. Mm-hmm. So I had a edited manuscript with all my grammatical things that had been corrected. And I had a bunch of those. Mm-hmm. And they told me things that this was just not relevant to the story. This should be taken out. Now, in some cases, I heeded their advice most of the cases. But in some cases, there were parts of the story I just wanted to keep in.
And
in
you
the
have
story.
That option. As the
oh, yeah, I'm the author. Yeah,
and,
you can
and
do
that's
it
right.
It,
so. And people need to understand that.
So I rewrote it and had it re-edited and then rewrote it and had it re-edited. And finally, I got to the point where I was ready to pitch it to mm-hmm. the publishing houses. And I, as Emily alluded briefly about literary agents, publishing houses will not read a manuscript unless they're submitted to them by a literary agent.
Or you find a mid-level publisher that's opened on soliciting.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
But the big boys and girls,
right, the
no.
big ones, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I went that route for a couple months. I sent what they call query letters.
Yep.
It's a very, very specifically written and mm-hmm. specifically to the big literary agents or all the I could find that would handle my genre. And I got a thanks, but no thanks back. Good story, but and I learned that unless you have a strong writing and publishing background, have been published, have an MFA from some school, mm-hmm. the good agents have the clientele that they want and can manage, and are really not that open unless you write something really, really unique. I also started looking at the economics of the publishing business and how this changing
yep.
and how the ebooks are coming along and how that's changing. So with a 40 years of marketing and sales experience and a law degree, I figured, and when I found out how little a publishing house will support a new author with tours and, mm-hmm. and marketing, I decided I would establish my own publishing company. So it was a matter of just establishing my own publishing company. I did that, and now everything's registered under the Library of Congress and the Bowker and all of those things are under
When I'm working with clients and they start off with I'm ready for the book tour thing, I said, let me tell you something,
I know what's coming.
Have you planned the itinerary, and do you have your money ready to go? Because whether you self-publish or are fortunate to get a big publishing company, the marketing is still yours.
Exactly.
And you mentioned the financial package there. If you go with a big company, you're going to get royalties.
Right.
But you get 8% of what they sell it at, not 8% of the list price.
Right.
If you self-publish, you get the difference between what it sold for and what it cost.
Right.
And that's more than 8% most of the time.
The way it worked out with me, my book is $15. It's a trade paperback book.
Mm-hmm.
It cost me $2 to print it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that in order to get the word out, I needed public relations and marketing support. So
yeah.
I hired on a six-month contract a fantastic public relations company that focuses just on books called mm-hmm. PR by the Book out of Austin, Texas, and I would highly recommend them. And they did a rollout campaign for me. They're the ones that contacted the media, the press, the TV, the radio, the newspapers, the magazines, and established initially the book tour that was I knew all along was going to be on my nickel.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
now the fortunate thing, so I had to pay for the public relations firm, and I think new authors might also, even on the big publishing houses, sometimes I get split, sometimes it gets picked up by the publishing house, sometimes it's left to the author. I've talked to authors where it's worked all those ways.
Yeah, but they still, the best advice is to be prepared to pay.
Right. So I, fortunately, I had the ways and means to be able to do all of this up front,
mm-hmm.
And I'm treating this book as... it's my third career, but it's the one that I don't I'm not relying on to buy groceries on. So it's I'm having the fun doing it. So I'll go out on the road, and we'll do a book tour just for the sheer fun of it.
Sure.
Now, one point I want to make before I forget about it. This is a tip I learned from another author recently that I highly recommend it. And Emily, you might keep this in mind too. I make myself available for book clubs over the phone. Mm. Anybody who contacts me that's in a book club that it wants to read Great and Beach Affair, anywhere in the country or the world for that matter, if they will just contact me with a little advance notice, I will call them on a speakerphone at their book club meeting.
Wow.
And I will spend, you know, right now I have the time to do it. I will spend, you know, as much time as they want around the table talking about the book and answering the book. I think it's a good marketing tool, but
so
it's
too.
Just, you know, it's a one more thing to think
sure.
about. But I do the book tours. I've done the TV. And I, you know, I get a lot of pleasure out of meeting the people in the book club. Yeah.
Well, could you give us your contact information?
Sure.
Because I want to open up for
sure.
a conversation. But people want your book, want to talk to you, want you for your
Absolutely.
Book club. What do they do?
All right. The book is Great and Beach Affair. The email address is j.harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y, at greatandbeachaffair.com. That's my website. The book is available in all the bookstores. That some of them would have to order it. It's available on Amazon. It's available on ebook. I immediately went to ebook as soon as the book came out.
Mm-hmm.
It's available on Kindle and Nook and all of those
Great.
Stories. So yeah, and then my address. Email me again, j.harvey at greatandbeachaffair.com. I'd love to hear from everybody.
Okay, now here's the highest risk part of this entire show.
What I'm going to talk? What's going on?
Well, that's the second highest risk. No, I'm opening up the mic. You two can
sure.
talk to each other, challenge Stone and me, whatever. Which means I have absolutely no control like I did at the beginning anyway. Any comments or questions you have for each other?
I have just a couple comments I want to just wrap make for aspiring authors. And maybe Emily would have some comments on this. I realize when I approached the book from purely from a marketing perspective, once I wrote the book, got the creative side finished and aside, then I had to look at the business side of it. I would recommend that you take you spend a lot of time and attention on your cover. When someone goes into
sure.
a bookstore, you have about 2 seconds for someone to pick up a book and look at the cover, and it's either going to catch their attention or not. Do you agree with that?
I completely. And also the very first paragraph of chapter one, because when I go book shopping, I open that. If it doesn't catch me, I'm putting the book down.
Yeah. I agree with that also. It has to catch your attention real quickly.
Well, it's not only the cover, it's the back cover with it.
Absolutely.
Because the usual process is we read the spine, so the spine has to be done well. Pull it off the shelf, turn it over, read the synopsis on the back, look at the table of contents, read the first paragraph.
Absolutely.
Right.
So those are the criticals.
Another thing that I would recommend is that, and this was kind of unusual in the publishing industry, this is my first book, and it came out in January of this year. I wanted the book to come out with some marketing blurbs on it. Because, again, when you pick up a book, if it's been endorsed by somebody or reviewed by somebody, well, traditionally what happens is an author prints a book and it goes out and then it does whatever it's going to do in the review process. And then by the time the second printing comes out, you've got some marketing blurbs that hopefully you can get put on, you know, that'll endorse the book. So with my marketing background, I decided I was going to put the cart before the horse on that one. So I actually printed 50 advance review copies. And my PR firm and I sent them out to the press, kept my fingers crossed. I just needed a half a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, I got some really nice blurbs back, which I was able to add to the back of the book and insert in the front cover of the book before I ever printed the first edition.
And that's great. And, you know, that you lift up a point, too, that one of our early guests back at the start of this show, Ahmad Miraji, shared. And that is, when you go to print the book, don't print 1,000 copies. You know, start small, like you did with 50. Because even though you edit and re-edit and proofread, there's still going to be a glitch. And you also get to find out how easy or difficult it is to sell or even give the book away.
Right.
And then everything you gain from that, you can put into the second round when you actually order.
Yeah. Well, actually, I did it. What I did, Tim, was I had 50 advanced review copies printed. And they were expensive to do it at that level. But I'm working with a fantastic company in Ohio called Bookmasters, who did the printing. The final editing, the printing, the typesetting, the printing, warehousing, distribution. I wanted to take myself out of that day-to-day accounting. And they shipped the book. They had the entree into Amazon and Barnes & Nobles and all the bookstores. So they're marketing. They have a marketing team that helps open those doors.
Mm-hmm.
But I went ahead with 2,000 copies. Yeah, because from an economic point of view, I just would do it.
Sure.
And I had some sense of confidence that I could sell a couple thousand copies. And that's the way I did it. But with the first 2,000 that came out already had the marketing blurbs in the front cover and on the back, which I think helped sales.
Good.
What I did, first of all, I'm going to just touch on a quick point that both of you made. I was a high school teacher as well. I taught for 1 year. That's all I needed. Loved it. It's a great memory. also, what I did for my social outings was I would go anytime an author was speaking, and I would listen to them talk about their story.
Wow.
And when I was writing the book, there was a guy that came here. He wrote the book Future Proof, and I asked him a question about, you know, basically what he did is he printed out, he self-published and then allowed the first 1,000 pages to be downloaded for free on Amazon, and then to finish the book, you had to buy the book. And he ended up getting picked up by HarperCollins.
Wow.
And so I went to him and I said, now that you're under HarperCollins, is it amazing? And he said, well, I don't want to burst your bubble, but do you see me in the bottom of a bar? I'm still doing my own promoting. I'm still on the road myself with my books in my trunk. You've got this Cinderella story, and I think that you need to come down a little. This is when I was running around town.
Oh, absolutely.
But what I did is I printed out 50 copies of my book, and I took them to New York to the Book Expo America and handed them out there and made an unbelievable amount of contacts. And then a book that I had written that I didn't even bring to the BEA is what got picked up by a publisher.
Is that right?
And now it's coming live in spring, and it's changed my whole dynamic to really back it up. And now I'm actually going to redo the anxiety books into one instead of From Fear to Faith and Anxiety Sucks. I'm redoing it and pitching it now because my publisher is going to help me pitch it if he doesn't pick it up to smaller houses of an Anxiety Sucks full, comprehensive, and then follow it up with a third one. But I got really lucky that way. But you got to get out there to any of those big book venues. If you have your book and you're ready to push and you know what area, like my From Fear to Faith is spiritual, so I went to the New Age Trade Show in Colorado, started there, and then did the Book Expo America out of New York twice now. This year I went and got to actually do a book signing there. But it is the most fun to be around all the people that love what you love and do what you do and on such a bigger scale, because when you send in to these agents or when you send in to these publishers, they don't know who you are. You're not already famous.
That's right.
But if you get in front of them and with your face, and I don't throw my picture all over the town generally on a business card, but at that I did. I put my picture on a card because then you go home after meeting 2,000 people and go, oh, yeah, that's that little short, spunky girl. I know her. And that's how I got picked up. And so,
but you're living testimony to what Jim has said, what we try to promote, and also what you have in your book. First off, you have to go out and do it. And if you have a wish, you got to work on it, right?
Absolutely.
Didn't somebody write that in a book here this
morning? Well, yes. Somebody wrote that, and then, you got the old product, where there's a will, there's an A, whatever way you want it. But, but it was a lot of fun to really take it and be social and put myself out there. But it was from the small New Age trade show that another guy said, why don't you go to New York? Why don't you try the BEA? You can be a self-published author and have your own table there.
Mm-hmm.
And they let me break it up into payment plan. I was broke as a joke when I'm doing this. And they let me pay over a whole year to get my table over there. And then the lady that I talked to so much, she now calls just to say, I need to pick me up. I need to hear your voice. How are you? What are you doing?
Wow.
She just called this week just to say,
and that is
hey.
That is a major event. It's held at the Jacob Javits Center.
It is.
It's annual. And the Writer's Digest magazine is a critical part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And It's just, it is. I attended it 1 year and was blown away.
I went to breakfast and John Grisham was speaking there and Condoleezza Rice and Barbara Streisand spoke the night before. I mean, you're in there. But the only thing that I will say about it is that I, you know, worked for an entire year to get the money, to get all my products, to get there, to push it. And then what it was the self-published authors were kind of in the back. Mm-hmm. And then it really is still a testimony to the famous people. So you have all these celebrities with their new books out and they're there for the book signing and their lines are lined up across the building and down the hall and, you know, for 2 hours at a time waiting for the celebrity to come in, sign the book. And so it still ends up being, if you're not somebody already, it's really hard to become somebody. And you know what? We're all humans. We're all somebody.
But what I like about that, what I like about that is, you were at the festival, and you had a table, and I think that could be a marketing tool for you. Everybody tries to find how they're the bestseller of something, and I know I met an individual one time who claimed to have a best-selling book, and when I pushed that individual, the answer was, well, I had all my friends go over to this Barnes & Noble at a certain day at a certain time, and it was the best-selling book in that store for that moment.
That's awesome.
Legitimate, you know. But it's not what we understand bestseller to be. I think somebody who has a table at the Book Expo in America has something going.
There's also the Southeastern Book Association that just had a big conference down in, I think, Charleston. They were, that I've just recently
That's
joined.
Right.
There's the Independent Book Publishing Association for me that's out of California, that's a national support system for authors.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a lot of marketing and support programs. And then there's the Southeastern Book organization that does an awful lot of stuff like that. But, you know, the bottom line, I think, is that you can write a great book, but you have to take off that creative hat and put on a marketing hat if you're ever going to
be
known.
That's my hard part.
Yeah.
I'm not a business. I'm listening to your story and I'm thinking, that is so cool. You ordered 2,000. You know how fast I could sell 2,000 copies if I could afford to buy 2,000 copies and throw them in my trunk and go around and, mm-hmm. and I have them in local bookstores and things like that. But the whole business part is so far over my head that,
well, I was just fortunate to bring that, you know,
that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, the clock is on us. It just has a habit of doing that every week. I welcome comments and suggestions from our listeners about the content or our guests. If you would like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. Simply send me an email, and that would be at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Thank you, Stone, for co-hosting, keeping me somewhat in line.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Thank you to our guests, Emily Francis and Jim Harvey. Emily, your contact information again?
Well, you can contact me at anxietysucks.net or my website is emilyafrancisbooks.com. I have two websites.
That works. Either one will work, right? And Jim, your contact information.
j.harvey@greatandbeachaffair.com.
Good. Well, Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services. Learn more about Right Choice Services at www.rightchoiceservices.com. I hope you will join us next week and tell your friends about the show. In fact, send them an email right now to invite them to listen live or to listen to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. at Right Here, Right Now. That's WRITE here, right now, businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business right here, right now.